Right, I think we shall start. I have to apologise for those of you who are expecting to see Leslie Hannah here. The acting director is sick, so I suppose that today I am the acting director. I'm Stephen Hill, I'm the pro-director, and it's a great pleasure for me today to welcome Professor Sudipto Bhattacharya to give his inaugural lecture. I think the Department of Accounting and Finance has been very lucky to recruit a man of such intellectual distinction and wide experience. He was a visiting professor at the Catholic University of Louvain at CENFI in Madrid between 1993 and 5. And before that, he was a professor of economics at the Delhi School of Economics. And before all that, he taught at the universities of Chicago, Stanford, Berkeley, and Michigan after attaining his PhD in finance and economics from MIT. So we've got somebody here of enormous intellectual distinction who's put in time in all the major centres. I think LSE's been very lucky to recruit him. The issues of corporate government are of pressing practical significance. That's just, I know, one aspect of what he's talking about, but this is an area where there's been considerable interest in the UK in the last few years at the practical level with reforms, with suggestions for reforms such as Cadbury and Greenbury. It's also an area of considerable intellectual challenge and considerable research opportunities. And the school indeed has had a long interest in these issues, and a considerable range of expertise has been built up across a fair number of the school's departments. So having Professor Bhattacharya here, it will add immensely to our strength, particularly as he's approaching this from the area of finance. Now, I have to confess, as a sociologist rather than as an economist, I shall be very interested to hear how these subjects are approached from the other side, and in particular, how comparative financial systems are evaluated. We've decided that if people wish to ask questions, 10 minutes can be set aside at the end. We do want to finish at 6:30 for the reception for those who are going to it. So without more ado, I'd like to welcome Professor Sudipto Bhattacharya to give his inaugural lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Since one of my specialties I bring to the department is also a somewhat silly sense of humor, I cannot help but reacting to the stories about all the moving around with the statement of somebody who was used to that, and he had a favorite line, which was to say that I go as I came, fired with enthusiasm. So here I am at LSE, and to stay, I think. And it is a particular pleasure to give this talk here because the fields that I'm going to touch upon in my talk have long been associated with several eminent scholars at LSE. Starting with, if you like, Hayek himself on the role of information in various mechanisms and market systems, to, of course, the seminal work of Ronald Coase on the theory of the firm, what it means to have an entity like a firm, what defines the boundaries of a firm, what limits on contractual relationships give rise to the role of a firm, which in turn has been aptly taken up as a theme, as a major theme in the research by Professor Oliver Hart, who used to be here when I first visited here in the 80s, and Professor John Hardman Moore. And today we also have people like Patrick Bolton, who unfortunately just left for the quieter life of Brussels, and I hope he'll be back, and Professor David Webb doing research in this area as well as others. And part of the goal of my lecture is to necessarily leave it sufficiently inchoate to goad some of these people into giving their own long-awaited inaugural lectures themselves. So in the unification of all our knowledge on this topic, we as an institution may be further enriched. So the topics that I touch upon have also to do with some of the themes that have been developing in the finance literature generally over the last two decades. And since I cannot claim to be really intimately an institutional expert on corporate governance as such, although many of the themes that I have been tried to work in, many of the areas, have probably as the ultimate goal issues closely related to corporate governance, I will still be approaching the topics more from a interrelated conceptual frameworks point of view rather than completely on the nitty-gritty of the corporate governance literature. So if I can pull that off within the time constraints, I'll be very happy. I won't burden you with many transparencies, but just some to keep the outline of the talk in mind. Maybe the surprise at the level of clarity of the transparency. So the goals, basically, that we're setting out in getting into a literature like this is to understand through the sort of lenses of looking at systems of financial intermediation or other systems of monitoring and control, the effectiveness and implications of alternating monitoring sort of and financing mechanisms in managing the sort of business activity in a more efficient direction. Possibly suggest in the process concrete reforms to regulations. So, for example, should portfolio constraints on banks or more importantly, I think, on other types of financial institutions be significantly relaxed in order to create the framework for the kind of holding patterns and financing patterns that might be more beneficial to corporate governance. And also in this process, of course, provide guidelines for the newer transition economies in organizing their financing systems and ownership structures, keeping in mind their special constraints such as perhaps a different initial distribution of wealth and savings patterns and so forth to start with. So as I said, much of the early literature owes its origins to the people I mentioned, particularly Coase and today Hart Moore and so on. And some of the references that cover this literature today, and this will give you an idea of how recent and active this field of research is. I wrote a survey paper on banking theory, which might give you a reasonably comprehensive idea of what's been happening there. Oliver Hart's seminal work on extending the Coasean framework to the theory of the firm, of theory of renegotiations with incomplete contracts, and in particular, the application of that framework to the question of financial structure on the liability side, where the genuinely innovative contributions lie, just came out with Clarendon Press. Michael Jensen has been long interested in these themes and was a topic of his presidential address in 1993 in Journal of Finance. On comparative systems and other systems other than the dominant sort of UK-US patterns we see in these countries. On the Japanese system, Aoki and Patrick have a recently edited book. Edwards and Fisher have a recent book on the German system. And trying to synthesize this literature from a somewhat institutional perspective, there's recent pieces by Margaret Blair on ownership and control, and survey papers by another set of people who've been doing extensive work in this area, Schleifer and Vishny. But the sort of a compression of this, all these pieces trying to synthesize this literature or trying to understand various aspects of it in just the last 3 years gives you an idea of just how active this field of research is and how active and talented the people who are trying to take a financial theory over the last 20, 30 years into this domain, how splendid a set that is. Now, where did we stand about 15 to 20 years ago regarding in corporate finance theory, and what have been the major themes pertaining to this literature since then? Well, we sort of understood that there were limitations to the Modigliani-Miller environment in which capital structure or the financial structure of the firm was largely irrelevant to its functioning. And these were modified both by frictions such as corporate and personal taxes, likely leaving some significant debt tax shield or advantage, and the problems of agency and asymmetric information. And the finance literature on these issues developed sort of in tandem with the information economics literature generally. One of the most earliest and seminal papers in information economics was Rothschild and Stiglitz's paper on adverse selection or a theory of deductibles, if you like, in insurance markets, which found fairly ready translation into financial markets context soon after. Now, the major topics involved were issues relating to shareholder-bondholder conflicts when shareholders have some advantage in dictating the choice processes, such as excessive risk-taking because shareholders gain from the upper tail of returns and don't lose as much on the lower tail, declaring default, essentially. And this literature had some wrinkles in the financial context, which I think were not perhaps adequately looked at, that some of the answer to these problems were that of rents to protect in the future. And at least some of us, including I in a paper in Journal of Finance in 82, warned that the 1980s bank deregulation, which was proceeding with deposit insurance, if anything, raised and without sufficient attention to protecting rents that might mitigate this problem of moral hazard, might well lead to seriously excessive risk-taking in banking systems, which are highly leveraged and particularly subject to these problems. There was a published warning in 82 to say that perhaps the whole topic of interest rate controls, which preserved rent in banking systems to some degree, ought to be rethought. Perhaps interest rate controls should be reformulated in index terms until other aspects of the regulatory framework which mitigated moral hazard with respect to risk-taking were in place. We were not listened to terribly well, and part of the consequence, as you know, is the large savings and loan crisis that the U.S. went through in the late 80s. So this literature clearly had relevance in very important problems of design of institutions, design of mechanisms for these environments. Another problem that was dealt with was by Myers about underinvestment with high debt overhang, particularly relevant to the sovereign debt crisis situation, where people soon realized that with very high debt overhangs resulting from unanticipatedly high real interest rates or terms of trade losses, these countries couldn't be expected to put in much further investment into export-oriented industries, and the lenders might actually become better off, at least concertedly reducing some of their demand for repayment and actually improve the likelihood of being repaid in the process if that accelerated the investment process in these economies. Issues that were also somewhat understood but later emphasized to a much greater degree have to do with conflicts not so much between insiders, shareholders and bondholders, but between what you might call insiders or managers in a sort of larger firm context, and versus external financiers generally, where perhaps the most mundane of these problems was that of incentive contracts for adequate effort choice, mundane in the sense that might be solvable with the least amount of distortion or least degree of rents being taken away from the financiers, and where classes of principal agent models dealing with sharecropping, dealing with agents in firms by Stiglitz and Merlis, who of course is one of the great seminal thinkers of the information economics field, rewarded with a Nobel Prize this year. Their work went into formulating rather exact and detailed models of the trade-offs between creating incentives for agents to provide effort versus the degree of risk sharing that could be achieved between agents and other financiers in the firm. Perhaps in a large firm context, the risk sharing trade-off, while it clearly exists, was not a major source of rent losses to the other financiers as a whole, and people started focusing on other aspects of the principal agent relationship with respect to insiders other than effort choice, which have to do with things like the consumption of perquisites, perhaps, but also rather generally specified private benefits of control. So, for example, during the 80s, it was suggested, late 70s and 80s, that managers had, this goes back to older hypothesis also, that managers had some sort of interest in just size maximization or going into conglomerate investments for the sake of it. For example, it was pointed out that U.S. oil exploring firms were kept on exploring domestic sources at a much higher cost than the price at which they could have bought already proven reserves. And it was unlikely to be just an explanation coming from two standard deviation tails of realized costs versus expected costs. It seemed to be just wasteful expenditure in a line of business that they were used to and comfortable with, whereas the money could have been better used in either paying out to shareholders or in other forms of activity. Now, having said that, the evidence seems clear-cut to some people. It seems less clear-cut to me, in the sense that organizing either large share repurchases and getting them taxed to the capital gains rate, or the other costs of mechanisms like leveraged buyouts to get rid of cash from inside the firm, had associated risks and costs. And it was not clear that given those associated risks and costs, firms which went into conglomerate merger activity were doing such a terrible disservice for their shareholders. And in fact, the documentation shows that while the degree of returns to bidders in conglomerate takeover activity were somewhat lower than in other kinds of takeover activity, there's very little documented record of very significant negative losses to firms which were buyers in conglomerate takeoffs. And this is relevant because many people have gone from these observations to note or proclaim the dramatic advantages of other means of channeling corporate resources in this setting, such as the leveraged buyout phenomenon, which got hold of a lot of people's imagination in the 80s, as dramatically better solutions to these problems. I would just like to qualify that by saying I'm not so sure that conglomerate merger activity to get rid of corporate free cash flow was such a bad use of money relative to leveraged buyouts, if half of the leveraged buyouts had to be unraveled 4 years down the road. Another line of activity on corporate financial models at that time was on costly signaling models of various activities that corporations undertook. It was understood that in situations where firms and their public financiers faced asymmetric information across them, firms knew much more about their possibly even their current earnings, but also certainly their future earnings prospects, that in those situations, in raising financing, external financing in general, involved a problem of adverse selection, of investors not knowing what was the quality of the firms whose assets they were subscribing to. And various models of financing, signaling in the process of financing were proposed. The earliest from the insurance context was a paper of Leland and Pyle, suggesting that just like deductibles in insurance, the degree of insider holdings in firms which are non-diversified could perhaps serve as a signal of the quality of the assets that the insiders believe the firm to possess. I myself joined the action at some point in my PhD thesis with a paper on dividends, where I went on to assume that not only future attributes, but also realized cash flows, realized economic earnings at least, are not completely verifiable to outsiders, with apologies to my accounting colleagues. But with that problem, and the problem of simply verifying the ongoing process of earnings generation is a problem. And a pre-commitment to pay out resources and a pre-commitment to raise those resources for those payout when earnings have a shortfall can serve as a costly signal, both because of the tax disadvantage of dividends and even a small amount of frictional cost of having to raise extra resources for paying pre-committed dividends. Stephen Ross, in a paper which looks mathematically rather similar, has a model in which debt serves as a signal, even though it was only a two-period model and he assumed that cash flows were verifiable ex post indicators ex post. I mention this paper in somewhat polemical terms because this has led to a critique of much of this literature in the later literature that came along, saying, well, you know, if you make all these assumptions, then why do you need financing as a communication device? Why do you simply not have managerial incentive schemes as a communication device? Just have the managers say, I commit to an earnings target, and if I fall short of it, I undergo a certain penalty. Why couldn't that be a signaling device instead? But before coming to that critique of this early literature, another issue that received a lot of attention in the corporate finance literature in the late 70s, early 80s, was that of the market for takeovers. And in attempting perhaps to rationalize the high degree of asymmetry in the sharing of gains from takeover processes empirically, that most of the gains, up to 25-30% premium relative to previous prices, seemed to go to target firms, and very little of the gain, if any, went to bidder firms. Grossman and Hart came along with the hypothesis of a free rider problem with small and atomistic shareholders, saying that when a bidder made a bid, and the bid was a simple unconditional bid with no two-tier pricing and no process of competition across bidders, in simple settings at least, an individual small shareholder had no incentive to tender his share. Because you know that if the bidder was rational, he was bidding a price that was no higher than what he expected the value to be. So why not hold on to your share and realize that value in the aftermarket? Why tender at any lower price to to the bidder, and which, of course, if such a free-riding problem was significant, then it would make it extremely hard for bidders to realize adequate returns to justify investigation costs and other frictional costs involved in the takeover process. And it was suggested that such extreme rent sharing could create problems in the market for corporate control and could be the justification behind what you observed in the data on the extent of rent sharing in these situations. Now, subsequently, there came along quite a few new developments emphasizing, or at least shifting the emphasis among some of these issues, and perhaps pertaining more to the corporate governance literature in the context of a managerial firm. So Vishnee and Schleifer emphasized the role of large shareholders in a firm as both directly in the monitoring and disciplining process for management and also vis-a-vis overcoming the free rider problem in takeover processes, saying if you were significant shareholder and there was a chance that you were going to be pivotal in determining whether takeover succeeded or not, you would not be subject to the free rider problem of just holding on to your shares for capital gains to the same degree. And later there have been more analytically complete analysis of these issues with finite-sized shareholders. One of the themes that is in the title of my paper, the theme of intermediation, generally received a great deal of attention from the early 80s, mid-80s on. Two early papers by Diamond and Ramakrishnan Tagore suggested that an important informational role of financial intermediation was to combine the two functions of unduplicated monitoring. So instead of investors directly monitoring the qualities of firms or realized earnings of firms, the intermediary agents could doing the monitoring. And in turn, the intermediary could signal to the market the credibility, not of its individual assets, but the credibility of the quality of its portfolio as a whole by some sort of signaling process of the costly kind that was dealt with earlier, but at a lower cost because of diversification within the intermediary portfolio. So the combination of unduplicated monitoring and diversification was to serve as a basis of a theory of intermediation. Jensen came back on the scene after Jensen and Meckling and started emphasizing that debt controls on firms had, in a sense, a role over and above whatever the implications of debt might be for the proportionate holdings of insiders. If you read Jensen and Meckling, the emphasis is largely on the fact that an insider who has holdings of, say, 2% of an unlevered firm, if that firm now becomes half-leveraged, then his proportionate holding in the levered firm goes up to 4% if he doesn't sell any of his shares. And the 4% might motivate him more than the 2% holding did earlier. And that was the degree to which debt mattered for insider holdings in the early Jensen-Meckling framework. Here, Jensen was saying something different. He was saying, well, over and above that, the fact that most of the time you have to pay interest on this higher 50% or 70% debt in the firm means that physically, if you like, in a cash flow sense, you're constrained from using those resources for other excessive or unjustifiable or negative NPV investments. And it's this sort of direct cash flow control on the manager that is probably as relevant or more relevant in sort of a rationing constraint almost, rather than trying to create in a costly way incentives through giving large shareholdings to insider managers in firms. The role of information linkages in banking, relationship banking, and the general idea of learning over time about other people's attributes in ongoing relationships rather than a one-shot process of communication or signaling resolving asymmetries gathered some momentum in the work of Sharp, Rajan, Von Thaden, Devatri Pomaskin, some of them very recent, and have sometimes been advanced as a possible basis for viewing financial systems across different countries. So, for example, Devatri Pomaskin have suggested that perhaps in financial systems with large lenders and ongoing relationships, you get a great deal more of learning over time about borrowers' attributes, whereas financial systems which are more public and involve smaller, decentralized holdings at any point in time perhaps result in less of such learning over time. It's not completely clear that that is the case. I mean, market-oriented financial systems have many institutions for information gathering and dissemination that are not just the holders of the securities, but brokerages, investment banks, et cetera, many other information gatherers and sellers. So it's to some degree an empirical question as to how, whether one can sharply differentiate financial systems that differ in the institutional structure vis-a-vis this dimension of how much learning over about institutions take place over time in these markets. And then finally, Oliver Hart's quite important, almost seminal view of the firm as a system of property rights and residual rights of control came to be in a series of papers. Hart Moore and their applications to the financial context by people like Aguillon and Bolton, and a different paper of Diotsipo and Tyrol were central pieces in this literature. Now, while not wishing at all to critique the general thrust of this literature, in the area of financial contracts, this literature's thrust is essentially, as far as I can judge from some papers of Oliver Hart, being that of saying the following. That if you had a reasonably reliable set of exposed performance indicators of firms available, so you had, with some noise, were able, but noise that was understood, noise that was certifiable to some degree, or the degree of noisiness was understood, if you had economic earnings indicators available for firms, then for most managerial firms, you could achieve most of the tasks of controlling managerial effort, or even communicating the attributes of the firm to the extent the manager knew them, through managerial incentive contracts, and financial structures and financial policy variables would have rather little a role to play in the process of information transmission and control. Perhaps at best some aggregation of outside information in stock prices reflecting more than just earnings information about the managerial performance could be useful, but financial policy on the part of the firm as such was likely to be of limited significance in a managerial firm context in resolving problems of information asymmetry. So from this trust and the empirical observation that in even in eras without tax, significant tax advantage for debt, you had rather determinate patterns of financial structure, this literature essentially went on to a view of saying, okay, let's assume that no verifiable or reliable indicators with reliably quantifiable degrees of noise about exposed performance are available at all. And the only threat that the financiers have is the threat to essentially remove some future cash flows or future private benefits of control or future rights to collateral assets from people who have borrowed from them through the contractual rights of a creditor to at least a subset of the assets or earnings generation capacity of the firm. And this threat was going to serve as the basis for getting some payout from the firm and some reward to the financiers. Now, of course, this led very much to a debt-oriented or liquidation-oriented or a threat-oriented view of financial processes, which, while of course it has a great deal of significance in some contexts, particularly firms at an exit stage of their life cycle or firms at, for whatever reason, close to bankruptcy, and the degree of inefficiencies involved in those processes may well depend on the extent and magnitudes of different kinds of debt in the capital structure. As an overall theory of corporate governance and control, it's perhaps still a bit premature to rely on just a framework of debt-oriented and threat-oriented control as the only basis for corporate control in the economy. And so I will be diverging from this literature a bit to emphasize other possible sources of control as well. In other words, what we do really need is a richer theory of other kinds of claims than debt in a framework that's somewhat consistent with a modified view of property rights or incomplete contracting before we can seriously contemplate talking about empirical issues in corporate governance along those lines. Now, what is the empirical evidence across particularly Anglo-Saxon economies but also others on the importance of some of these relations? And their implications for corporate functioning. Well, large shareholders, the evidence seems to be that, yes, they matter, in the sense that if you go out there cross-sectionally and look at available summary statistics like Tobin's Q, the value over investment ratio in a firm, that measures like that, which are market-based measures of the economic efficiency with which the firm is being run, do seem to go up with large shareholder holdings, but not beyond about 5% or so holdings. And if firms have large shareholders able to, sufficiently motivated to monitor what's happening to the firm, what's happening to its prospects, its line of business, and at least able to put items on the shareholder meeting agenda, and is motivated enough to do so, it doesn't take much more than a holding of 5 or 6% in the firms to create these monitoring processes. And beyond that, there doesn't seem to be much of a systematic impact of large shareholder holdings on firm valuation in this sense. It was also noted empirically that managerial turnover, replacement of supposedly bad managers in response to bad performance, also goes up somewhat with large shareholder presence, but again, not by much beyond this 5 to 10% holdings by large shareholders. What about the role of main banks and relationship banking? Was there any role for that? And particularly the documentation of evidence in this area comes largely from non-Anglo-Saxon economies, where you find these roles to be, at least a priori, more important. And it was found in some early empirical work that there was indeed some degree of seeming advantage of these systems in helping firms cope with liquidity problems and sort of cash flow shortfalls that were in the short-term ones, in that there seemed to be lower correlations among internal cash flows and investments for firms with large bank ties compared to firms without large bank ties in a Japanese context. This evidence has been questioned. There is a question of self-selection or whether you should really interpret that as firms facing very significant financing constraints if there were not enough main bank tie, versus firms making really small marginal trade-offs, saying, okay, if there isn't a large correlation between my current cash flows and investment opportunities, then I'll be in this sort of renegotiation situations much of the time, so I'd rather get institutional debt where renegotiation is easier. Whereas if whenever I'm down, I'm really down, so I don't have to invest much either, I don't need to renegotiate debt very often, and I would go on to more decentralized forms of financing. However, there is not much direct prospect for the other claims or the stronger claims of some of the relationship banking literature, in that some of the stronger relationship banking literature, which would say that if you don't have systems with relationship-specific investment in learning, then the other kind is one where essentially no learning about prospects takes place over time, and everything has to be dealt with through short-term indicators and signals. And as a result, such systems may have problems of what was referred to as short-termism, that there might be excessive investments in projects generating early cash flows as an indicator of the firm's ability, rather than higher gestation periods with greater understanding and knowledge of the firm's longer-term investment prospects. There seemed to be very little evidence that market-based systems in any systematic way undervalued firms with more cash flows more in the future. That if you looked at simple models of the dividend growth valuation kind, but adjusting for risk, and ask, given that market adjustment for risk, did growth per se make a difference to the value of the firm's assets relative to the book value or replacement value? Or did particular items of expenditure in the firm's investment portfolio, such as a greater weighting towards R&D and investments of that type, which are likely to be longer term, did that make a difference to the Q ratio in a systematic way? The answer, except for one dissenting study in the UK context, but at least in the US context, seems to largely say no, there doesn't seem to be much of a systematic evidence of that sort. In other words, this is suggestive to me that what happens in relationship banking systems is largely at least a small degree of extra flexibility in coping with crisis situations relating to a liquidity squeeze. But in terms of a systematic advantage in monitoring the future prospects of these firms, there probably isn't a discernible difference across relationship banking systems versus market-oriented systems. And if you look at even the evidence of what banks do, or Japanese banks do and German banks do, as the internal cash flow positions of many of these firms in these economies have improved over the last decades, there is concrete evidence that very few of these organizations, lending organizations, ever look at even the 2-year, 3-year, or 5-year business plans of the firms they're lending to. And it's largely in coping with situations of liquidity shortage that the institutional role becomes somewhat important. Other kinds of studies have looked at aggregative multi-country growth rate studies over much larger samples, trying to ask whether the institutional structure of financing, as well as other measures of the aggregate development of financial systems, does that make a difference regarding the growth rates of these economies? And particularly Rajan and Zingales' study, which tries to look at differential growth rates of sectors which need external financing to a greater degree. So they're asking essentially that in economies where some measure of bank or market activity, financial activity relative to GDP is higher, that is it true that in those economies, sectors which on average need a greater degree of external financing relative to internal cash flows for investments, that their growth rate is higher or is not slowed down by the same degree from the problems of raising external financing due to perhaps informational problems in large part? And do these institutions, markets or banks, do they help in mitigating the problems associated with asymmetric information external financing? And the answer seems to be yes for the overall sum of stock market value and bank credit relative to GDP. It turns out also the bank credit coefficient turns out to be 2.5 times higher than the stock market coefficient in this regression, suggesting the bank credit helps even more. But that's a very weak measure because the stock market value coefficient doesn't come to really reflect the stock market inflows going into these firms. But the bank credit coefficient is much more closely linked, or linked with much lesser degree of noise, to the incremental inflow from the banking sector into these firms, whereas the fluctuations in the valuation ratio reflect much greater error, and the coefficient is quite likely to be biased downwards just for that reason. In fact, the contrary evidence comes from a study of Levine, which finds that over and above a bank credit or overall credit market, financial market development indices, what seems to matter very strongly and systematically and positively for growth rates across economies is a measure of stock market liquidity or volume of activity in the stock market, as perhaps a measure of the degree to which information is quickly and cheaply available in markets. Because most models, or at least some models of the rational expectations kind, would suggest that in markets where other patterns, liquidity trading, etc., equal, the volume of trading would increase if it was cheaper for the informed people to acquire information at a lower cost or at a greater precision. And perhaps this is indicative of underlying structural advantages of the economies in having created institutional legal procedures and also institutions for disseminating information in a more cost-effective way across market participants, which is one reason why the volume index could be showing up as such a strong predictor of differential growth rates. But as I said, the evidence is somewhat mixed, so it's not easy to conclude that one system versus another is generating substantially different outcomes regarding the long-run behavior of the economies. On other more nitty-gritty evidence, there is some tests of testing models where essentially the shareholder-manager conflict has been underemphasized and the conflicts of information revelation across current and future shareholders emphasized. In particular, Bernheim asks that in the overall, not just talking about contexts of firms which should exit, like oil firms digging away uneconomic wells, but overall, is the data more in support of a model in which firms are using corporate payout policy to signal something about their attributes versus models in which payout commitments are essentially being used to throttle management's capacity to do something else with the money? And the data seems to be more consistent in its behavior vis-a-vis changes of tax rates. It's a somewhat indirect test, but I like it since it supports my story. somewhat more supportive of the attribute communication story rather than the direct controls and managers story. Similarly, there's been a lot of empirical studies of managerial incentive contracts and rather incomplete attempts to ask if they're high-powered or low-powered in some sense. Jensen and Murphy have a study showing, registering surprise that it's so low-powered, that on average, increase in the valuation of a firm, which might result from a manager being installed or working harder, results only in a 0.35% increase in annual top management income as a proportion to the value increase. I'm not so completely shocked that it's 0.35%. If you take a shareholder who's monitoring with 5% shareholdings, and if his monitoring results in higher earnings, which are valued with a 10 times price earnings multiple, then his delta E over delta P, the increase in the earnings accruing to him, which is 1/20th of that, would be exactly 0.5% of the increase in value. So if a monitoring shareholder with 5% stake in the firm registers an increase in earnings to increase in valuation ratio of 0.5%, and 5% shareholders are adequate for monitoring, what's so bad about managers registering ratios of 3.5%, in large firms at least? It's not so a priori obvious that these are such low-powered incentive schemes. And also, it has been the case that if it's incentive component of pay, whether for legislative reasons or awareness reasons, has been significantly increasing over the last decade. So it's not that incentive pay has been in decline or has become outmoded or infeasible. From roughly, on average, in U.S. firms, 1/3 to 2/3 of a component of manager's salaries. Now, nevertheless, there have been other more dramatic predictions of these models, which have sometimes resulted in strong behavioral activity, which I'm somewhat skeptical about. For example, there are some claims that collapse of intermediation, mind you, collapse of intermediation, not general problems of net worth loss and collateral problems, but collapse of intermediation led to a large degree of persistence in the Great Depression and 50% output drop over an 8-year period in the 1930s in economies like the US. If you actually look at the data, it was far from a collapse of intermediation. There were certainly strong behavioral changes vis-a-vis loan-to-deposit ratios of banks and so on, but very few banks, relatively speaking, were affected by bankruptcy as such, and perhaps other models concentrating on problems of net worth loss and collateral in the lending process rather than any fine-tuning of an intermediation are more relevant. And of course, the LBO activity. Jensen's suggestion that particularly in exiting firms, the direct payout restrictions arising from leveraged buyouts or high degrees of debt in the capital structure is relevant, went along with or perhaps encouraged the philosophical belief in such activity to a large degree. And I was myself surprised by the numbers that over the decade from 83 to 93, the amount of U.S. equity buybacks amounted to about 10% of the market value of the, at least the New York Stock Exchange, at the end of that period. So $600 billion of this activity went on. And so clearly some people at least believed in these stories to a greater degree than I was inclined to. Now, briefly, I will come to the last topic of comparative systems. And do these studies, incomplete as they are, help us at all in concluding some things about different commonly observed control systems, and whether some of these institutions should be grafted onto other systems as sort of hybrid mechanisms that might improve their performance. Now, if you look at on the surface of things, there clearly are large institutional differences across in patterns of holdings across different economies. Institutional holdings have been increasing everywhere, 50% roughly in U.S. and Japan, more than that, much more than that in the U.K. The German system seems to be characterized largely by reliance not on bank holdings, but on a great deal of very large insider holdings in firms, in the sense that 80% or over of firms in a medium to large size have individual or family shareholdings above 25% of the shares of the firm, very different from the pattern in the U.S., for example. Direct holdings of corporate equity by firms, although somewhat significant in the top 100 firms, is insignificant overall in the German economy. Proxy holdings are large, But nobody's going to convince me that having told stories about monitoring and monitoring incentives, that having the right to proxy votes gives a bank a significant incentive to keep doing ongoing monitoring of a firm in a situation outside a crisis or a bankruptcy situation. Okay? That it's just not, you don't get the gains for the cost you have to put in to monitor the proxy votes with the same diligence you would have monitored a 20% direct shareholding. The direct shareholdings for main banks and other lenders are larger in Japan. There's probably a greater ability to put together coalitions to remove incumbent management that is not performing well. In addition, another feature that's observed that many have tried to comment on is the role of affiliate, supplier, etc. holdings in Japanese firms, which is different from both Germany and US. And it's tend to be large, amounting to about 25% of the equity holdings in these economies. Now, some in particular quite well-known scholars who worked in this field for longer than I have in corporate governance directly, such as Schleifer and Vishni, have ended up concluding that maybe what it really all means, that it really doesn't matter, that you really should have systems which have stronger legal protection, at least very strong ones for some set of income claim holders, either minority shareholders in the U.S. scheme or creditors with having swift rights to seize control of assets, as is claimed in Germany, and so on. And as long as some residual rights of control are strong, some set of large blockholder will take part in the system and will keep it going in a reasonably efficient way. And it really doesn't matter which it devolves to, and that may be largely a question of historical accident. Now, that may be true, but it is also copying out a bit in terms of trying to give an answer to where the transition economies should be going. And in particular, in the absence of domestically large concentrations of wealth, should they be bringing in large shareholders directly by encouraging a great deal of foreign investment directly than some of them would like to? Or would intermediated systems, with a role played by, say, funds managers providing expertise in return for some rights to the firms, but not 50% control rights, would that be an adequate substitute for corporate governance mechanisms? And these questions clearly matter, at least as far as distributional issues or questions of degrees of foreign ownership, etc., are concerned. And just saying that evolution is a matter of historical accident doesn't begin to address these questions. So with that in mind, I've looked a bit at the literature on what people who have studied the U.S. system and looked at some of these things say about the possibility of grafting some of these mechanisms onto Anglo-Saxon patterns. And my conclusion in the end is that it seems to be that there is a case to be made for greater institutional stable long-term holdings by institutions such as pension funds in economies of the Anglo-Saxon kinds. And I'm talking about situations in which you have large pension funds or agglomerations of pension funds being managed by people with more expertise, investing up to 20-25%. So a couple of them together have effective control of a firm. A couple helps. In these situations of ongoing learning about firms, it turns out that two people who do ongoing learning about a firm is often much better for governance, because they can extract less in the way of monopoly rents from the firm in future financing and so on. That pattern in which each mutual fund may be held, each pension fund held equity in 100 firms and took 25% stakes in each with some degree or fairly adequate degree of diversification with fairly stable stakes could be not an unviable system. And the expertise for this system, while in corporate governance, while clearly currently lacking, the sources of personnel that would be available to these systems, essentially frustrated partners of consulting firms who are not going to make directors, should be the people starting management companies for such pension fund agglomerations, clearly exists at least in some economies. And you're talking about situations in which funds are holding 20-40% of individual portfolio components, and in turn giving out maybe management fee contracts with 10% to 20% incentive structure to them, resulting in the managerial firm, the managerial entity of this pension funds, the managerial subcontractor, having in effect roughly a 5 to 10%, let's say 5% stake directly in the performance of the component portfolio funds. That's a system that's more or less in line with the evidence, and that's a system that is not so out of line with management fees, and at least in the context of hedge funds and so on, which should not be so far and so difficult to contemplate and should not be dismissed out of hand. In fact, in Blair's book, after a very balanced and somewhat perhaps even fearful discussion of the many critiques that have been raised of these ideas, she herself ends up concluding that perhaps a relaxation of investment controls and insider trading laws to allow this degree of concentration of up to 20-25% holding in portfolio firms by pension funds ought to be allowed in investment law and practice. Okay? The last piece of evidence that I'd like to focus a bit on is this affiliate supplier holdings in Japanese firms, which really is significantly different feature from other systems, and the way people have tried to explain that or explain its implications, and related to the theme of knowledge, which I didn't really bring out so far. And knowledge is a theme where I have tried to work on, and it has to do with economic circumstances in which you are not just trying to know something about the attributes of another entity, but there is a gain to be had from, if you like, sharing out your attribute. So, for example, technological knowledge. If you could share out your technological knowledge or get somebody else's technological knowledge, it might improve simultaneously the performance in terms of future innovative activity of both of you. But of course, in the absence of a reward scheme, either directly or indirectly, once you have a lead, you're not inclined to share such knowledge with another person just freely, because it cuts down your prospect of first invention or early invention in a situation. So these are what I would call proprietary information environments, as opposed to just simple private information environments, where learning about somebody else's attributes transfers some of it to you and not just makes you more knowledgeable about the other person. Okay? Now, one of the things that has been suggested in the Japanese context by people who have studied these sort of patterns has been to say that these patterns help in several of these following respects. First of all, you get a degree of monitoring by agents because they have, say, 5-6% holdings of firms they hold shares in, and these are agents who understand the business, that long before cash flows have started shrinking and they can't make the interest payments, they understand something is wrong, the quality of the product is declining, the timeliness of delivery is declining, something needs to change about current management practices. Again, they can advise or put coalitions together of minority shareholders to put pressure on management in these respects. In a sense, this is just an extension of an argument that was made by banks long ago, going back to as early as Fisher Black in the early 70s, the late Fisher Black, saying one reason banks may be good at monitoring at least the exposed outcomes of firms is that they see the exposed outcomes pass through their account, right? So they know what was an expense and what was an investment, what was paid when and what could have been postponed. And they have a much greater degree of knowledge, maybe not of prospects, but at least of realized outcomes than other monitors or auditors could. And this is a similar argument being made about prospects, really. The current declines showing up, which would soon reflect themselves in future earnings and future earnings prospects, being made on behalf of monitors who are also business partners. In addition, some work by Gilson and Rowe, who are prominent scholars in the corporate governance literature, sort of branching out into this comparative governance systems work now, have suggested that cross-shareholdings serve as a bulwark against opportunism in systems where you have incomplete contracts and relation-specific investments, that where, say, one firm needs to build a plant near another in order for the venture to be worthwhile, and the other firm sees a certain advantage in changing its location plans, it doesn't do that, and it hangs in there for the long run. Now, a problem which they realize and emphasize in their own article is the following, that if these situations of opportunistic investments and opportunistic decisions are largely zero-sum, that what I gain by making an opportunistic decision is comparable in magnitude to what you lose, then how come a small stake, a 5 or 6% stake in your firm, would really help me deal with these problems? In the sense that I might say, okay, you know, you'll suffer a loss of 40 when I gain only 30. So overall, I should have stuck to you, but my share of your 40 is only 6%. So the 6% loss is still low compared, or 40 is still low compared to 30. So let me do things in my own self-interest. Okay? One possible answer to that, and way out of this, maybe to look at the problems of sharing of interim knowledge and its transfer in a more detailed way than this literature has. Although in an instinctive and institutional way, it has grasped onto the fact that these problems of incomplete contracting and relation-specific investments may be particularly acute in the context of knowledge-specific or high-technology industries. It hasn't really concretely identified what is it about these processes that makes these things more germane in those contexts. And some of my recent work with Chiesa and also with Depremont Gerard Ferre, and as well as a recent work by another LSE colleague, Marie Sacco, on affiliate firms in the Japanese automobile industry, suggests that there are situations in which, suppose some sort of interim knowledge is soft knowledge, it's not patentable, you can't get worldwide marketing rights for it, but you can create some degree of externalities by sharing it in a small talking shop. But suppose this sort of disclosure nevertheless is completely unverifiable. Even from that small talking shop, you could never collect a license fee for it. Well, in these situations, it might help to have a third party who hangs in there with both of you, in the sense that for both of you, ex ante, before you know which one of you has the higher degree of this soft knowledge, you want to commit to sharing this knowledge. But once you have a lead, you don't. But if you say are two component suppliers to Toyota, and Toyota holds only a 6% stake, but a 6% stake in both of you, and in the process of seeing your input supplies knows that you've made some technological improvements, it's in Toyota's interest to kind of put your heads together and say, look, I know you've improved something here. You better tell the other guy what you have, because it's in Toyota's interest that both of them improve or have a higher chance of going on even to the next stage of innovative activity. That it's not a zero-sum game across these two as far as Toyota is concerned. Okay? So that's an extreme kind of situation in which co-financing or co-ownership, even to a small degree, can help in aligning interim or ex-post incentives with ex-ante incentives to share knowledge. A more subtle issue in these environments is that it turns out that these public good environments of knowledge are very different regarding the extent to which any surplus from some knowledge sharing is shared equally or in an extremal way across participants. So just as you had a problem of extremal surplus sharing in the takeover context, remember going back to Grossman Hart, it turns out that in contexts involving such public goods, often, surprisingly, the buyer, who is less informed, has an enormous advantage in being able to extract both disclosure and a very large share of the surplus from that disclosure from the seller. So just as any other frictional cost may make takeover processes difficult, any frictional cost to searching out bilateral trading partners may make selling of such knowledge difficult, even if conceptually some verifiability accrues to it and some licensing is possible. And here's a situation in which maybe even a small stake could grease the wheels, that in the absence of a stake, you'd be essentially getting zero surplus from any knowledge sharing with the other party. But if you have at least a small stake in the other party's gains, that greases the wheels enough for you to undertake the frictional costs of searching for the partner. Much as the story of toeholds and takeovers, that if the free riding problem is a serious problem in takeovers, so if you start from scratch, you have to essentially give away all your gains to the bidders, and if you could have instead surreptitiously accumulated 6% of the stake, then at least you keep the gains on that 6% of the stake, and that provides you enough incentive to do a little more work on the takeover. Similarly, the story of co-ownership across related firms in interrelated and high-tech systems with a lot of soft knowledge to be shared across small talking shops may be linked to the issue of toeholds and greasing the wheels for sharing, which would otherwise become difficult. So those are the observations I have to make. They're necessarily partial in nature. I don't have all the global answers. I've tried to put some coherence in the structure of the theory and evidence in this literature, but clearly very much more remains to be done. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for some considerable tour de force. a huge range of literature, a large number of countries, and some rather controversial conclusions towards the end. We don't have much time, but would people like to put any questions? Up there, yes.
Yeah, well, certainly the question is whether, in the light of the observations I and others have made, with a more lenient set of disclosure rules regarding share accumulation in firms, which might be your takeover target, for example, right, be of benefit regarding the issue of incentives. And certainly not just me, but Grossman Hart, very early on, once when they were emphasizing the free rider problem, argued that indeed there are situations in which the frictional costs were large enough that having a more lenient set of disclosure rules for prior accumulation would help in the process.
Any other questions? Well, the time is after 6:30, so perhaps the best thing is to finish at that point. Thank Professor Bhattacharya extremely much, very much indeed.
Thank you.